From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. From laws about who can get fired and why, to discussions about what to do when someone pulls a gun on you, it's been a busy first week on the talk show.
We're going to start with a phone call that led to a lengthy discussion. We were talking about a recent federal court ruling. The court decided that employers can fire someone for wearing dreadlocks to work. The court explained that you can't fire someone based on race because race is immutable. It can't be changed. But a hairstyle can be changed, so the court decided employers have the right to tell employees not to wear dreadlocks.
Here's the problem for many African Americans. Dreadlocks is the obvious choice, the natural choice for their hair because of the texture and how it grows. Straightening the hair to make it look more like white people's hair can take hours. So for some black workers, this decision felt like a way to allow discrimination.
We had Rena Golden Collier on the program, a black woman who has worked in various sectors, the corporate world, music production, consulting. She has dreadlocks. A caller named Don said he didn't believe her when she said that most African Americans who wear dreadlocks do so because it's the natural choice. Here's their discussion.
They told me I needed to wear a certain tie for certain jobs. They told me that in certain places I had to wear certain types of clothes. And I know people right now who have to wear a special type of elegant suit to work. And people have a right to say how your appearance. And then, like this one lady said, oh, she doesn't think her hair is messy. You know, who defines messy? Well, I must say that out of the dreadlocks I see, 9 out of 10 look very unkempt. And someone who is unkempt gives a bad appearance at work. And I don't care what this lady says about who's to decide what's messy. Let me finish.
Okay, go
ahead. If I wanted to go to work wearing a T-shirt because that's me and that's the way I want to look, but the company tells me I should wear a certain tie, I think there's a certain right. The companies have some right in saying how you should appear.
Don, I see people with dreads all the time, and their hair looks professional and great.
I have a question. I just want to know what, this idea of neat or kept, it still suggests, it really just reeks of the idea of assimilation to a standard that is unlike my own natural standard. It would be like we were asking you to alter your physical appearance to look more like mine, so that I'm more comfortable and I think it looks neater. I think it looks better if your skin were darker and there's a way that you can make it darker. I just need you to just tan a lot more. Or your hair should be thicker. It should be thicker and it should be kinkier. Is there some kind of product that you could do, some sort of chemical alteration that you can do to make your hair thicker and just curlier, because I just think that looks neater on people. That's what I would be asking you to do if I were in a position of majority and of power. So let's just say you lived outside of America in the rest of the world where people of color are the world majority, and everywhere you went, you were being looked at as so different that it's not even just different. It's unprofessional, and it just looks messy for your hair to be all over the place. Can you corn roll it? Can you do something to tame it a little bit more, because it just doesn't look right that the way it comes out of your head? Do you get what I'm getting at all, Don?
When I was younger, I had kinky hair that had to be thinned in order to match the styles. My hair was very, very kinky and curly when I was young. So I understand what it is to have that.
Yeah, so this isn't about a uniform.
Anything to do with that. My natural thing is to not comb my hair. My natural thing is to just be sloppy. Doesn't look neat.
Yeah, I don't want to get into an argument or anything
with you, Don. What I'm talking about.
I'm going to put you on hold there, Don, because I do want Rena to have a chance to finish. Go ahead, Rena.
Yeah, I don't want to argue, at all this point, and that really is my major point, that we shouldn't have to argue about these things. I shouldn't have to defend my hair, you know, because it looks or it styles differently than the majority in the workplace or those who have the power to say what is or isn't neat, what is or isn't messy. That's really the issue. This isn't about me wearing a uniform. It's more about that I have to actually physically alter my hair in order to style it in a way that an employer feels comfortable. And now, you know, there's a law that, you know, or precedent that's been set that this is okay. And this all started because the company was not comfortable with the choice that this woman made to style her natural hair, the way she styled her natural hair. That came about because of race, because they, you know, they weren't comfortable with it, or they thought that that looked messy or similar to what I think Don or
Don,
Dan is
yeah,
saying.
Don. So, yeah. And I'll just follow up briefly with you here, Don. The problem I have is it's not even an implication. You are basically saying straight out that if you met Rena and you see her hair, you would assume it's, what was the term, you unclean or unkept?
He said unkept. Like, he has no idea what it takes to keep my hair. Like, none at all. Most people don't understand.
And
I do a lot more than just jump in the shower, shampoo it, and I see people come, you know, I have colleagues that come to work with their hair wet still. So I know they don't have to do anything to it because they literally jump out of the shower, put on their clothes, and by the time they get to work, it's actually still wet. I have to do a lot more to keep my hair.
And so, Don, what concerns me is you talk about your own hair, you had tight curls in your hair, and that you felt like you could understand that you had to, you know, do certain things to your hair to conform. But this is not a case of, well, people with dreadlocks just aren't keeping their hair clean and they're not professional. I have to say what you're implying is that's what it is, and that's not correct.
That doesn't escape me that what we're talking about when we talk about appearance is we're talking about preference. We're talking about what I prefer to see. Don said a lot about what he preferred to see. And employers are also talking about what they prefer to see. And their preference is still, you know, is still based in some sort of social and racial construct that, you know, that creates a bias that I prefer to see hair look this way. And if it's this far away from this preference, I might consider it messy, unkept, unneat,
untrustable,
all these,
Rena. He used the term have to be able to trust.
Yeah, that's deep. That's deep. And that's real.
Let's turn to journalistic ethics. In particular, we're talking about photography. Recently, the New York Times ran a photo on its front page showing a Turkish assassin who had just shot and killed the Russian ambassador during a news conference.
Our guests defended that decision to run the photo. We talked to Max Schulte, the lead photographer for the Democrat and Chronicle, and Jen Poggi, an RIT professor and former Associated Press photo editor. They also discussed a photo from 1991 that most of us have not seen. It's an image of an Iraqi soldier burned to death in his truck after an American airstrike. That image was essentially rejected by the AP as too graphic. Poggi thinks that was a mistake. You'll hear her in this clip, but first you'll hear Max Schulte explaining why that photograph had value to the public.
I think the criticism of there were other images moved from all of that destruction along that, I think they called it the highway of hell.
Yeah.
You know, and it was basically images of bombed out trucks, tanks, the occasional limousine, I think, was spotted in there. But that was a sanitized version of what happened. What really happened was these guys were caught in an airstrike, a very strategic airstrike, and they were annihilated sitting in their vehicles. So I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what depicts what happened more accurately? Are bombed out vehicles an accurate depiction, or is that a sanitized version of the war that was fought, as opposed to the charred remains of bodies that never escaped their vehicles as they were basically bombed while in retreat, actually?
Would you have run it on the front page? Would you have put it on an inside page? Would you have put it online only? Would you have added any kind of disclaimer?
I think it depends on the institution I was working for, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've made a number of other similar calls. I mean, remarkably, picture editors see a number of images that have graphic content, that have questionable content, you know, daily. It's just a reality of the industry and the amount of images and the availability and accessibility of photography in the world we live in today. So, yeah, I would not have a problem running that. But you make a call based on the circumstances of that story, of that day. There really, I think I was mentioning to you before we came on, there's no hard and fast rule, yes, always publish. I mean, and the bottom line is it involves a lot of discussion, or it should involve a great deal of discussion. I think you have to remember that the world we live in and publish in today is very different than the one in 1991 when that image was made.
Yeah.
And at that point, the main vehicle to see an image like this was on the front page of a newspaper, your
That's
local
right.
newspaper, yep. perhaps, you know, something like USA Today, or for it to be published or broadcast. And so a disclaimer on the front page is something that's difficult to do. A lot of times, and there were other pictures that moved from that situation, but the decision of whether you put it on the front page is very much a different one than putting it on the jump inside.
Next, Donald Trump and the United Nations. The next president has said he wants to change America's relationship with the UN, particularly in its stance regarding Israel. Our panel discussed how Trump might or might not attempt to shift the UN's role, and in this clip, we're talking about Syria.
This is Randy Stone, the director of the Skolny Center for Central and Eastern European Studies at the University of Rochester. He says Syria is a real risk for Trump and could define his foreign policy.
Well, Trump's biggest break on Syria with the Obama administration is that he signaled that he's willing to let Assad stay in power, which makes it possible for an agreement that Russia would be willing to accept. So that makes it possible that there could be a UN Security Council resolution that might lead to some kind of coordinated response. He's indicated also an eagerness to engage in a much more, well, full-bodied way in fighting ISIS. And I don't know what that will look like, whether he will decide in cooler moment that maybe that's actually a very bad idea and pull back from it. But that could look like a substantial escalation. So if the United States invests a lot of resources in Syria, presumably involving boots on the ground, and also engages with other countries to try to reach a multilateral solution, we will then lose a lot of leverage over what Syria ultimately looks like, because we will then have a substantial investment in being able to extract those forces after we've put them in. And so I anticipate that if this actually goes forward, this will become the defining foreign policy of the Trump administration, because it will be a long-term, very costly investment in a very unstable region. And I don't see any way to get a decent solution in Syria. There was no credible force there that the Obama administration really felt good about supporting, which is why they never went in a big way.
Yeah.
So you're going to end up with some kind of an ugly dictatorship when you leave. And in order to withdraw, you're going to have to pretend that it's good enough. I don't see much of a payoff.
You don't?
I think if he's just planning how do I maximize my chances of getting reelected in 4 years, he should stay as far away from Syria as he possibly can. But I think his instincts are pulling him the other way. He has this kind of need not to be seen as a loser, I think.
Or weak.
Yeah. Right? It seems to be an important motivation. We'll learn a lot more about, you know, what his personal demons are and what their impact on the international system are going to be. But it looks like he may feel compelled to double down on Syria. And if he does, he's going to pull us into another quagmire in the Middle East.
Here in Rochester, there's an ongoing debate about how to make sure people living in poverty can gain access to jobs. Many people in poverty don't have a car. They rely on the bus system.
Pete Nabosny is a researcher who wrote a series of articles for an organization called Reconnect Rochester. He says the downtown transit center is where a lot of people end up or pass through, but there's a problem. That's not where the jobs are.
We shouldn't be building parking garages next to our most transit accessible place in the city. And the truth is that transit center is completely surrounded by surface lots, which is kind of crazy, but also garages. And I understand why. And there's a lot of dynamics that go into recruiting, you know, employers downtown and new development and things like that, and this desire for parking. But I think we need to be kind of strategic about how we're organizing our area around the transit center and recognizing that that's the most transit accessible place that we have. And if people could hop off the bus and go and walk a half a block to work, then that becomes a much more viable opportunity for a lot of people in terms of taking the bus. And that benefits everybody. That's more ridership, so you have more frequency. If it's a low-income person who has a job downtown, then their commute was just cut by more than half. And if it's other folks who live in other areas and they can take a no-transfer bus to their workplace, they may opt to ride the bus rather than drive and try to find parking and deal with that hassle. So I just think we need to be thinking really differently and building upon a lot of the work we've been doing in that part of the city, but with an eye towards making, you know, investments in transit-friendly buildings and business development and creating an area there that's accessible to pedestrians, to people who are riding their bicycles, to all sorts of different folks so that we can really build up that area for everybody in our community, not just for those who are lower income. We're responsible for our zoning and our planning and our efforts to recruit businesses to the area here. And if we take a regional approach to these things, we can really make an impact, I think, on helping lower-income folks achieve kind of greater economic mobility and access more jobs and support their families.
Let's close with a conversation that took an unexpected turn. Dominic Barter is the founder of a kind of justice system known as restorative circles. He created that system in Rio de Janeiro in the mid-1990s where he lives. The idea is to bring people together to discuss violence and justice and what they should do to build a stronger community. Critics say it's too idealistic, not strong enough. Barter says it can work and make remarkable change.
He was in Rochester this week to work with teachers and students, and he visited the talk show. And during that visit, he revealed that he was recently held up at gunpoint. And even at that moment, Barter says he was able to rely on his restorative circles approach.
We had a good conversation, and we decided what of my resources that I was carrying we were going to distribute. And I know that sounds almost humorous to say it that way, but that really is the most accurate way to describe what happened. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we left on really good terms. And when I say good terms, I don't just mean increasing our safety, but in terms of there really being no animosity. I'm not interested in defining another person by the superficial characteristics that are the first thing that I see. I'm interested in establishing a relationship with that human being. I live with them. You know, those kids who held me up, they're my responsibility, even though they're not directly part of my family. So their well-being is just as important as my well-being. And that's the way I want to end my day, having had relationships that increased our safety and our well-being and our understanding of each other.
Now, typically, the average person in that scenario, well, there's no average. I mean, some people run, some people fight, some people say, I'll give you whatever you want, just get out of here, and then they call the police. I'm imagining you're conversing in a very different way, that you're telling them that you care about them, that you want... Did you ask them questions?
Well, the first thing is I'm more selfish, perhaps, than people who choose other strategies. I'm really interested in leaving there in good terms myself. I want my physical safety looked after. I want to live long and look after my daughter and do my work. So I'm not interested in doing anything that increases the danger. And what I found is that any animosity, any adversarial dynamic in that situation increases the danger. So the first thing I'm doing is making sure that I'm well.
Okay. And then are you talking to them? Are you asking them just, you know, are you asking them what they want? Are you asking them anything about themselves?
Yeah. The first thing I want them to know is that it's safe enough for them to be able to put away the guns. Because as long as they're holding a gun to my head, then they're in much more danger than I am in terms of anybody else who might see what they're doing. So that's the first thing I want to make sure that they know, is that this is not a situation where they need to use physical force in order for me to consider their needs and their well-being.
Okay. And did they do that? Did they put the weapon
they
away?
They yeah. did. Yeah.
Okay. And then after they put the weapon away, what do you do?
So then I'm interested in making sure that we're understanding each other. And that's just the same as in a restorative circle. I don't want to presume that message sent is message received, because there are so many different reasons I might have to filter their message, to interpret it, to misunderstand it. So I want to make sure that I'm really, really understanding them. So just like a pilot talking to the control tower when they're landing a plane, I want to make sure that the message that is sent is reflected back so that we know that we're on the same page. We don't presume that we're understanding each other.
You know, Dominic, there will be people who say, well, what you've done is encourage them to do that to other people, that they think that they can get away with that and that it's the wrong lesson. What do you say to that?
Well, I have never actually met, it's been 21 years now that I've been doing this work, whether in prison or in a police station or in a school or on the street, I've never met anybody of any age who prefers to behave in ways that increase the risk for themselves and to other people. What I've met is people who say there's no choice. There's no other way. I have no other option. So my curiosity is to see how can, even in a very, very small amount of time, we establish the principle that actually there is choice about what's happening. So in that situation, I'm pretty confident that I'm not encouraging what's happening, because by not justifying the use of force by resisting, the only thing they have is their own distaste at the way they're behaving.
That's our podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. You can join us for Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And you can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. She's Megan. I'm Evan. Have a lovely weekend. We'll talk with you Monday afternoon on Connections.